and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and on this New Year's Day, we are continuing the retrospective of programs from 2018, and we begin with the Mueller inquiry, which, of course, is dominating the year and will probably dominate 2019. We'll be joined by Harry Litman, former Deputy Attorney General in the Justice Department, talking about how Trump's acting Attorney General has neither the legal, ethical, moral, or judicial qualifications for the job. And of course, he's put in there by Trump to wreck the Mueller inquiry. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who currently is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Mueller Probe Could Be in Mortal Danger," as well as an article at the New York Times, "Congress Can Issue Subpoenas, Will They Matter?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thank you. And it's a pretty alarming development, just starting with yesterday's very combative press conference. It was pretty clear that Donald Trump was laying down a marker, basically saying if the Congress investigates him, it'll be war. And, you know, if they want to make a deal, then no investigations. And we also know that this character that he's put in charge of the Justice Department is somebody that's effectively auditioned for the job for some time by appearing on CNN, obviously getting Trump's attention. The White House engineered his move to the Justice Department to become chief of staff of Jeff Sessions, and now they've made him the acting attorney general. Let's deal with the constitutionality. There's some people questioning that, including Kellyanne Conway's husband.
That's right. Yeah, he's written an op-ed, as has Neil Katyal, a really respected constitutional scholar, suggesting that what's certainly clear about it is also unconstitutional about it, and that is an attempt to bypass the Senate's ability to confirm the Attorney General. There is a statute they are purporting to act under, they are acting under, which is designed, however, for kind of emergency situations where someone has died or resigned, and you can install a replacement for a discrete period of time. Of course, here that's not what happened under any reasonable interpretation. Even the Sessions quote-unquote resignation letter says, as you requested. It was clear that before the votes were even counted in the midterm that the chief of staff, John Kelly, called him up and said, you're to resign now. In fact, he asked for a couple days for a leave of stay of execution, and it was not granted. So it's kind of make-believe that this was a real resignation, and that could matter under the law, which is designed for these sort of surprise events where all of a sudden things are left unoccupied. And as you say, Matt Whitaker, who, you know, it was obviously part of a plan to put him in, has one credential and one credential only. That's he's a political actor with loyalty to the president. He's previously expressed the views that the probe has gone too far. He actually comes first to Sessions and now to the president via the recommendation, this hasn't really been reported, of Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, who is also the Sherpa for Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court appointees. So it's very alarming. My best guess is that the constitutional argument won't succeed, and in any event, it will take quite a while for it to work its way through the courts. You'll first have to get someone withstanding, and then there'll be a lawsuit. But by that time, Whitaker will have had a chance to do quite a lot of damage to the probe, and there's real reason to think that he might.
Well, let's talk about that. He's already in charge of Mueller at this point.
I actually think this is government by tweet, but that's not an effective way to put someone in. He's going to be any second for all I know. It's happened in the last half hour, but the actual order from the president appears not quite to have been entered, but it doesn't. As we talk now, I think it's still Rod Rosenstein, but that's a matter of you know, hours or minutes. So, yes, he will, if he's not already in charge, he will be very, very soon.
So we know that this guy is basically a propagandist, and he doesn't have the facts, and he doesn't have much standing in the law and experience. And we know he's a political hack, if not a political executioner. So if he goes to Mueller, is there any way that Mueller can say to him, look, this is what we found out? Because I'm pretty sure that Mueller's pretty much found out that our president, who acts like a criminal, may well be a criminal, if not a traitor. I mean, what we've learned so far from the Mueller probe is pretty alarming. But if there's some big shoes to drop, which I'm absolutely certain there is there any way that this guy can be told, look, this is what's going on here, and this is what we need to make public, and this is what we need to deal with? Or is he just completely blind? He doesn't care, just like Trump. They just want to shut this thing down.
No, look, I think there is. He is basically a political actor. He's a failed two-time candidate in Iowa and ran Rick Perry's campaign. But he was a U.S. attorney for a time, and it's clear he understands that Mueller is an estimable figure. He will, you know, one worry, of course, is he's made his put himself where he is now by being the, quote, eyes and ears of the White House. So if Mueller gives that to him, will he pass it along, which would be, you know, completely illegal. But I think if it's explosive enough, he will, you could imagine him staying his hand. And, of course, in order to shut him down, there are rules in place. You know, he could run roughshod over them or maybe even try to repeal them. But it has to be, in order to countermand a particular investigative step, he has to find that it's deeply inappropriate based on DOJ policies. And in doing so, he has to give great deference to the views of the special counsel. So if we've got smoking guns here, it will not be easy for him to simply overlook them. Now, of course, the report itself, when it reveals this, is it will be within his power to try to keep it from the public eye. It's his judgment whether it's in the public interest to release it. And we know Team Trump has previously sought to keep it from being released. So that's a concrete fear. But he is, I worry deeply about him because other potential attorneys general have at least functioned within the culture of the Department of Justice. Jeff Sessions is a good example, or John Ashcroft, where they've understood that there are things you can't, you know, there's a certain DNA that you can't violate. He is not that guy. He's completely uncredentialed. So he might. But if we have pictures of Trump getting a payoff from Putin, it would be so precarious and career-ending and probably criminal for him to smother it that I don't think he will. Of course, if you're wrong, Ian, and what we have is more equivocal, that's the perfect situation for him to, you know, basically, you know, shut things down.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Mueller Probe Could Be in Mortal Danger," as well as an article at the New York Times, "Congress Can Issue Subpoenas, Will They Matter?" So just to sum up, as soon as Whitaker finds out what Mueller knows, which presumably being his boss, he's able to find out in either, we think that the full report is perhaps close to being finished. So,
well, at least on the obstruction of justice charges.
Right.
There are, you know, three discrete subject matters, but yes.
Yeah, but
the obstruction may be close.
Yeah, but couldn't you make the case that we're in a situation where obstruction of justice is happening in plain sight? I mean, that's what my concern is, that this person has been put in there for the express reason to obstruct justice. So
you actually can make the case and imagine. I mean, he has already said that he will, you know, Sessions, like any attorney general in history, listened when the professional folks said you have to recuse. He's already made it clear that if the professional folks tell him he has to recuse, he will thumb his nose at them and not do it, which is a stunning thing to say as you're taking the helm of the Department of Justice. But if he's doing that and there's actually a whiff of obstruction in his own appointment, now we have this impossible tangled web where, in addition to everything else, he is a criminal subject in the probe. And so it's beyond nasty. And in that situation, he absolutely, absolutely, absolutely would have to recuse. But that the final decision rests with the Attorney General of the United States. So if he's ready to really be political and brazen like his sponsor, he could try to tough it out.
So just to sum up then, he could become a spy and help Trump in by letting him know what they have on him.
That would be illegal, but he could.
He could. And he certainly could. And I don't know whether he could use the word legal, but he could certainly bury the report, right? There's no obligation for this report to be made public.
No, and that seems to be, you know, his real decision to make. That could be done. My instinct is, especially with the new House majority, that it's fanciful to believe that the report will never see the light of day. But it could be bottled up pretty well and certainly give Trump a lot of kind of time to ride it out. And remember, I don't think this is his decision, but the report could be anything from a full-bodied report to a simple bare-bones recitation of conclusions and actions in the absence of a real exposition of all the evidence he's found. And so, you know, that for me, the most frightening thought, and one I've always believed couldn't happen, but there's so many things with Trump I believe couldn't happen, and then they happen, is that the truth will not out. That the, you know, down the line, he actually may succeed in keeping from public view and even history his various misdeeds. And that is so unsettling, and I would say even un-American, although that's a dramatic way to put it. So that's a horrifying prospect. And it is much more likely now with Whitaker's appointment.
Well, just in closing, we suspect, at least I do, that the Mueller inquiry, because so much evidence has already surfaced about Trump's ties to Russia and the extent of Russian money laundering and how his business was essentially propped up by the Russians for decades, there's an awful lot of information already on the record. And you've got some key players like Manafort and Cohen who have been deeply involved in this, who are already testifying, and Mueller already presumably knows all about this stuff. So
yeah, that's right.
We have a president who, if he's not a criminal and a traitor, he certainly acts like a gangster. When he talks about Sessions, he basically says, I'm mad at him because he didn't protect me. I wanted the Attorney General to be my lawyer to protect me from the law, not to be the chief law enforcement of the United States. That is not hyperbole. That is the attitude the president has. So is this guy that he's just put in there basically his consigliere?
Yeah, has he found his Roy Cohn?
Right.
Of course, Roy Cohn was a smart, cunning, malevolent guy. This guy, I think, is much less nuanced and legally sophisticated. And, you know, the Department of Justice is a very big place with quite a lot of important initiatives to oversee, and now he oversees them all. I mean, the short answer to your question, I don't like to be too alarmist or knee-jerk, but I see no other reason. Yes, he's his guy. He's the guy he wanted to put the boot on the neck of the Mueller probe. I don't see any other way to explain it. And, you know, whether he'll be able to do it will, I think, in part depend on the strength of the evidence. And there is now at least the possibility of some minimal House oversight. But there's the real possibility that this just all happens in plain view and that the American people are not, contrary to your hypothesis, you know, outraged enough to keep it from happening. That's, you know, Trump has normally bet in that direction to date, and he's been, his bets have paid off more than they haven't. So it's all, you know, just right. For people who care about the rule of law and the truth, it's a very alarming situation.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, Harry Lipman's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Mueller Probe Could Be in Mortal Danger," as well as an article at the New York Times, "Congress Can Issue Subpoenas, Will They Matter?" And that is an interview from November of 2018 with former Deputy Attorney General Harry Lipman about the extent to which Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker is a deliberate attempt to sabotage, if not scuttle, the Mueller inquiry. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into, of course, another big story of 2018, and that was the November elections. We'll be back with a program from November the 12th, shortly after the elections, talking about how Beto O'Rourke's small donations might be the way forward for Democrats to run against corruption. And we'll be speaking with Lawrence Lessig. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and founder of Equal Citizens US, a nonprofit dedicated to reforms that will achieve citizen equality. He's the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic, and most recently, America Compromised. His latest article at The Guardian is Beto O'Rourke's Biggest Blind Spot Cost Him Texas. Democrats Take Note. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Lawrence. And what is, in your opinion, Beto O'Rourke's biggest blind spot?
Well, you know, there's a theory about how Democrats are going to win that suggests that the way to win is to be as bold and progressive as we can be. And that will inspire people to follow the leadership which bold progressive ideas offers. And Beto O'Rourke was, I think, the best example of that theory being tested in a very difficult context, which was Texas, where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 9 points in 2016. Now, you couldn't have a better candidate. You couldn't have a better, stronger progressive message. You couldn't have more money. He had twice the amount of money that Ted Cruz had. But in the end, it became very difficult for him to offer something to Texas Republicans or Texas independents that gave them a reason to support him, because he made the primary message that he had focused on the deeply progressive ideas that he had. Now, my suggestion in alternative isn't to change his progressive ideas. I love him. I love his progressive ideas. I think they're wonderful. But I think that we see in other candidates like Billy Sutton from South Dakota, the fact that if a Democrat were to lead on the question of the corruption of our democracy and the failure of our democracy to actually represent Americans, that it would give Republicans and independents a reason to support the Democrat that wouldn't require them basically negating their own views. And so I think that his big mistake was not making the reform message central enough to basically give people an excuse, people in the middle and people on the right, an excuse for supporting him, even though they knew that his more fundamental beliefs were not theirs.
But I think in large part, his success at fundraising had a lot to do with his progressive ideas.
Well, it had a lot to do with both his progressive views and actually his anti-corruption views. You know, he started off in the very beginning as one of the first candidates in the 2018 cycle
to forgo corporate or to forgo PACs. He was more expansive than corporate PACs. He forgo he forewent all PACs, and that actually ignited a kind of excitement around his campaign as people were talking about this clean money candidate running against Ted Cruz, because of course Ted Cruz is the epitome of incumbents supporting the idea of big money driving the way politics works. So in the very beginning, I think that he had a real opportunity to define and to build on this message. But the concern is that if you don't make this central enough, if people don't understand that this is a fundamental thing you're fighting for, then for people, you know, who are not deeply progressive, it's hard for them to reconcile themselves to supporting a candidate like that.
So, in other words, you think that he should have really touted his own success more, in the sense that I'm the alternative. You know, one of the things that I find distressing about our money-driven politics, and you've been on the case for some time, Lawrence, is that, in effect, the Democrats and the Republicans get their money from the same big donors. The difference is that the Republicans have more affinity with their donors ideologically and politically, whereas the Democrats essentially get their money from the same big donors, but their votes from the people who arguably the big donors are screwing over.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that's another way of making the point I'm trying to make. You know, I think that the success that he had in raising small-dollar funding without PAC money could have been a focal point of the campaign. Look, this is what a democracy responsive to the people could look like, and that's the thing I want to build, and that's the thing I'm going to fight for in Congress. We're going to get reform legislation to end this corrupted system. Now, you know, I'm also, he could say, a strong progressive. I also believe in single-payer health care. I also believe in, you know, reforming or abolishing ICE. I also, you know, believe strongly in the integrity of the Black Lives Matter movement. Those are all things I believe as well. This is not, you know, reform is not a left-right issue. It's a democracy issue. And so I think that if he led on that, it would have been easier to pull people over. And the evidence that, you know, I offer in this piece for this is really an undertold story, but I think a really important story, which is Billy Sutton in South Dakota. Now, Billy ran in a state where for governor, in a state where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 30 points. And he came within 3.5 points of beating his Republican opponent. But his campaign from the very beginning was focused on restoring trust and integrity to government. He was focused in a very big way on the corruption issue. And my point is that, you know, you could see many more Republicans in South Dakota saying, well, you know, he's a Democrat, but he does believe in ending this corruption, which I do too. You can see many more of them supporting him for that than you can imagine Republicans saying, you know, I'm a right-wing Republican, but this guy's really persuasive. I think I'll vote for somebody who basically disagrees with everything substantively that I disagree with. You know, the point is you have to confess error as a Republican in Texas to support Beto. But in South Dakota, you didn't have to confess any error at all. You have to affirm your belief in having a democracy that actually represents the people rather than special interests.
Well, of course, the states that we're talking about, Texas and South Dakota, it wasn't that long ago that they were solidly Democratic, particularly when you think of George McGovern from South Dakota. So what happened to the liberals in the sense that, you know, in the 70s, they dominated the judiciary, the House and the Senate and the White House? And structurally, it looks as though going into the future, the Democrats may never have the Senate, because by the year 2040, 70 senators will come from red states, depopulated red states, and only 30 senators will come from heavily populated blue states. That seems to be a major structural challenge.
Yeah, I think this relates to a deeper challenge with the Democratic Party. You know, because I think it's hard for the Democratic Party to say both and. They're very good at saying either or. So, you know, I think the Democratic Party has a large number of coalitions built around really important issues of identity politics. Equality is still a really critical issue in American democracy. And we have not achieved it. We've not achieved it with race. We've not achieved it with sex, with sexual orientation, with immigration, all sorts of issues that are deeply identity politics related. But to big parts of America, that's not enough. It's not enough to be concerned with transgendered bathrooms. You've also got to be really committed to rebuilding a middle class that could actually flourish. And I think that the Democrats are too easily sort of led into this reactive mode, especially by Donald Trump and Breitbart News, where they're constantly triggered in response to identity politics stories and lose the opportunity to deliver a solid economic independence story. And so, you know, these middle class, mainly whites from South Dakota or North Dakota or, you know, the Rust Belt, so-called Reagan Democrats, don't really hear in the party the echoes of a message or a platform that could really benefit them. And so, you know, when Donald Trump comes along and Donald Trump says the problem is the elites, the problem is the political correctness, the problem is all these insiders, and I'm going to blow the system up, drain the swamp, and deliver something to you, it's so appealing and attractive because there's no clear alternative to it that is believable or messaged effectively. So I think the Democrats have a long-term struggle to kind of restore themselves as the party of the middle class. And of course, the facts back them up so powerfully because the Republican Party has become so beholden to money that they bend over backwards to make money happen. So, you know, since Donald Trump is president, we have, you know, major tax reform to benefit corporations and the ultra rich. But we have very little from this administration that actually benefits the middle class, certainly not the middle class that elected him, certainly not the Rust Belt Democrats and Rust Belt Republicans who elected him. And so I think that's an opportunity for the Democrats, but I fear the Democrats have not yet found the discipline to deliver on that.
Well, it seems to a mixed bag, though, Lawrence Lessig, in as much as the Democrats lost Senate seats in the South, whereas they picked up a whole lot of House seats. And the South is not monolithically red because the urban centers are blue. And so how, as a candidate, do you navigate between the blue urban centers and the rest of the red state? Let's take Beto, for example.
I think you need to speak in a way that can attract both sides. And that doesn't mean speaking, you know, out of both sides of your mouth, but it does mean speaking in a way that's sensitive to where there might be common ground with the other side and what's necessary to rally your base. So I think that the urban centers, you know, and the progressives inside of Texas, the kind of Austins of Texas, we're incredibly excited by this authentic, passionate believer in fundamental principles of equality and justice, standing up and defending, you know, the take a knee movement, and standing up and defending single-payer health care. I think that mobilized them. And they would not have been turned off by him also saying, but hey, look, we're not going to get any of this stuff, any of the things we want, if we don't fix this corrupted democracy first. None of that message would have been antagonistic to anything the progressives cared about. In fact, many progressives, I hope most progressives, kind of in the heart of heart, realize that. But the point is, if he had stood up and he said, look, this is a corrupted democracy, the richest people in our democracy basically have grabbed hold of the controls of our government, and we're never going to get anything that benefits any of us, whether on the right or the left, until we fix that. If that had been a central part of the message, then people outside of the Austin circles would also have heard a message that they could have resonated with, and it would have made it easier for many of them to rally, I think, to a person who was so deeply compelling compared to, you know, this quintessential politician of Ted Cruz. So, you know, it's just offering more common ground, where there is genuine common ground, not to compromise on anything, but to affirm something that I'm sure I know Beto O'Rourke believes. I think that's the strategy I think we have to keep in view. It's not enough to rally the progressive base. It's not enough. You've also got to give moderates and conservatives something that they can agree with, too. And that doesn't mean compromising progressive faith. It means complementing it with a fundamental issue which we know practically every American believes in, and that's this corruption of our democracy.
Well, it was clear that Donald Trump absolutely stole that issue in the primaries. You recall when he was asked about donations and money in politics, he said, yeah, I donate to them all, you know, and he turned to the people on the stage, his fellow Republicans, including Ted Cruz, and said, I've given all these people money, you know, and when I need them, I pick up the phone and they're there for me. And that was a powerful moment. And it's
Ian, and it's so few remember that. I mean, you're exactly right. And I think that's one of the most important and exciting things about that election was to have a Republican standing on stage calling out the power of big money in our politics. Now, I didn't believe him. And obviously, he didn't believe it himself because, you know, though he said he would drain the swamps, he's done literally not a single thing to drain the swamp. What he's done is he's filled the swamp with a bunch of people that are, you know, trying to corrupt the system to benefit him. I mean, the level of corruption here is orders of magnitude worse than anything we've seen, I think, in the history of the Republic. But put that aside, the point is there were so many Republicans who rallied to Donald Trump because they were so angry with the corruption of the system. And certainly, it's bizarre to think, but certainly he succeeded in grabbing that issue over Hillary Clinton. And that was, you know, I think a big chunk of the people who supported him because that's what they really cared about. There's no reason he should own that issue. We should own that issue.
Sure.
Because I think that the Democrats have actually done a lot more to put this issue at the center and to defend it in a really credible way. And if we did that consistently, I think that we could begin to win back a whole bunch of the people who are so disenchanted with the Democrats.
Well, indeed, I think the point you're making is that the Democrats should have owned that issue so that Trump wouldn't have been able to capture it. And that's an indictment, which it goes back to the point that essentially they get their money from the same people, both of these parties. So let's just finish up that one back to Beto and Texas. My sense, though, is that this is a huge issue that's really, I think, the Democrats are not coherent on. And that was very central, and that is immigration. And Trump, as you know, has been beating the drum about this caravan business and the border. O'Rourke has an extremely nuanced and subtle and sophisticated and really decent approach to immigration. He keeps pointing out that the safest city in America is El Paso, the city that he represents. But that message didn't get through. So what can the Democrats do to get some coherence about immigration? Because there is a sense in this country, particularly amongst the white working class, that they're losing the country, and it's allowing demagogues like Trump to exploit that. So what would your suggestion be of a policy for the Democrats on immigration?
You know, the only way the Democrats win on immigration is by making an economic miracle return to America. You know, the fact is immigration is driven by anxiety. And it's kind of bizarre that people making $1,000 an hour have convinced people making $40 an hour that the real problem in America is people making $8 an hour. But that's what they've accomplished. And they've accomplished it because of this deep anxiety produced by an economy that is failing to deliver or keep promises with middle-class America. So that's the thing, that's the critical thing that we need to focus on. And, you know, the scare tactics of a caravan are things we can't really control because the reality is that the rest of the world's doing badly as well. And America is the shining city on the hill, as the Republicans used to remind us. Of course, those phrases are now forgotten by the current Republican Party. But as, you know, Ronald Reagan told us, we're the shining city of the hill, which is why everybody wants to come here. We used to welcome them. We used to say to them, you know, if you have a legitimate claim, we're going to welcome you in our country. But I think that the critical thing is to take away the anxiety, and we remove the anxiety by beginning to deliver on values and an economy that middle-class America can believe in. So, you know, if you're in Ohio and you don't have a retirement and you don't have a guarantee of health care and you're looking at a future where you're not even sure what your job is going to be in 2 years, you're looking for any scapegoat, but begin to relieve some of those anxieties And you can begin to inspire people to think beyond the pettiness and hatred of the anti-immigration movement. And so that's where my focus would be. And I think, you know, Beto, I think, did a brilliant job in diffusing and in tempering as much as was possible the immigration issue. But the reality is, you know, with Fox News on your side and the constant pounding of this completely made-up threat to America from a bunch of immigrants marching up Mexico, you succeeded in you know, getting a bunch of people to think we just got to support the president. And the president obviously came down strong for lying Ted.
Well, Lawrence Lessig, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and founder of Equal Citizen U.S., a nonprofit dedicated to reforms that will achieve citizen equality. He's the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic, and most recently, America Compromised. And his latest article at The Guardian is Beto O'Rourke's Biggest Blind Spot Cost Him Texas. Democrats, take note. And that is an interview from November the 12th of 2018 with Lawrence Lessig, Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. And we were talking about how small donations, which of course is very much the legacy of Senator Bernie Sanders, might be the way forward for Democrats in the future to compete with the big advantage the Republicans have from unlimited funds from plutocrats. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Matt Taibbi about his new book, Hate Incorporated.
It's the money.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Taibbi, who's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. He's the author of I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street, and the New York Times bestsellers Insane Clown President, The Divide, Griftopia, and The Great Derangement. And his latest book just out is Hate Inc., How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate One Another, Your Campaign 2020 Guide to Media Deception. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Taibbi.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks, Matt. And tell us about this different way of publishing that you are engaged in with your new book, Hate Inc.
Yeah, so I'm publishing serially at a site called taibbi.substack.com. It actually comes in the form of a newsletter, and then it's going to be a physical book when it actually is done. I'm almost done. So it'll be a book probably in March. But yeah, I had a lot of heroes when I was growing up, writers who wrote books serially in magazines like Black Mask and that sort of thing. And I was approached to do this, and I thought it would be a fun idea, and it has been. So.
Well, you've said you started to serialize this book as a rethink of manufacturing consent by Noam Chomsky. And, of course, Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent, highlighted how, and this came out in the mid-1980s, highlighted how the press manufactured public unity by making sure the population was only exposed to a narrow range of political ideas stretching from Republican to Democrat, with the Democrat usually more like the Eisenhower Republican. So that's pretty much how it was with Uncle Walter Cronkite reading the news. In those days, there was a consensus in this country about what is true and what is real. Now we have 30 to 40% of the country locked in the Fox News bubble, where they're impervious to facts and information, and where they believe the rest of the press is fake news. So it's a different environment. Given that, it's almost like we were better off, at least. I mean, in other words, how can a country and the most powerful country on the face of the planet operate when there's no consensus about what is true and what is real?
Yeah, I started to worry about this in a book I wrote actually 10 years ago called The Great Derangement, where I talked about how the atomization of the media landscape meant that we really no longer had a commonly accepted, commonly debated set of facts. And what's happened now, though, and I started to notice this first in the 2012 campaign, but it was especially apparent in 2015, is that across the board on both the left and the right, the hostility towards the press is at an all-time high, and there's this unbelievable level of distrust out there. And it's not just from Fox viewers, it's from lots of people. I think it stems from a lot of factors, including mistakes we made, like the WMD episode. And then there's also a perception that the press for years played too much of a role in deciding who the candidates were. And I think that was one of the reasons why people chose Donald Trump in 2015. So this is some of the stuff that I tried to write about in this book, is that, you know, the some of the ways that we're incentivized to cover politics have backfired on us in a big way.
Well, one of the most alarming facts is that two-thirds of Americans get their news via Facebook, which aggregates, and what they tend to do is share their pre-existing biases and ideas and often conspiracies amongst themselves. So there's a new phenomenon now called reality shopping, where liberals get their reality from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting. Again, the trend is in the direction that you were alarmed about back when you wrote The Great Derangement.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And the phenomenon of the web algorithms, the social media algorithms, has massively accelerated that problem, because now there's an incredible premium on retaining your target audience, because the way the algorithms are set up, it's designed to funnel stories to people that the algorithm guesses that you're going to like. So if you do a story, let's just say, for instance, that you're a relatively liberal outlet whose audience tends to like Barack Obama, if you do a story that's negative about Barack Obama, it may not get through on the Facebook feed, or it may be deranked in the Google feed. And so, you know, there's an unconscious pull to just sort of throw stories back at your demographic that you know that they're going to agree with. And that's true across the political spectrum, and I think that's pretty scary.
So in other words, that reinforces the notion of preaching to the choir, because quite often or not, I find it interesting to talk to conservatives, in particular people that have been on the inside of government. For example, people that have served in the military or the CIA, where they actually have some secrets that are kept from the American people. So as a journalist, it's my sense that these are the very people you need to go after to find out what the hell's going on, assuming they're going to tell you the whole truth and nothing but the truth, which of course is a big assumption. But I can't tell you how much hate mail I get for being, you get accused of being a CIA stooge for simply talking to a former CIA officer. So that, to my mind, I think is an unfortunate example of how much we've all sort of been siloed here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, some of that is a function of some pretty cynical campaigns that you mostly see on the right. I mean, I think it was most explicit on Donald Trump's campaign. He was pretty open about it. I remember covering him and being behind the rope line, and he would begin his speeches by pointing at us and saying, "Look at these bloodsuckers, they hate me," and he was sort of inviting people in the crowd to kind of see the reporters as the representatives of the elite, which of course solved his own accessibility problem, because he was the real upper class billionaire in the room. But there's been a conscious effort to try to paint the press corps as part of an elitist system. And unfortunately, those criticisms aren't 100% off base, I would say. You know, there certainly is some evidence that we spend a little bit too much time in the company of politicians and consultants and each other, and not enough in the population, which is one reason we missed a lot of stories in 2016.
Well, but we have journalists as celebrities, do we not? A lot of the anchors on TV, particularly the talking heads, they demand, what, $50,000 for a speech on the lecture circuit?
Sure, yeah. No, absolutely. And they've become stars in their own right in a way that they never were before. And that's also reflective of a new reality, a financial reality in the business that's very unfortunate. When the 24-hour news cycle came and we had just these oceans and oceans of time and space to fill, we figured out pretty quickly that the easiest way to develop content was not to do actual reporting and research, but just to have people on the air and have them arguing about stuff. You'd get one person from the left and one person from the right, and you bring up a topic and people would yell at each other, and these people would become essentially entertainment personalities. It was a good way to fill time, but it wasn't necessarily informative, and it also sort of ritualized the idea of political combat, and people got used to the idea that you're always supposed to be arguing with somebody in politics, and I think that was very negative, too.
Well, I remember the amazing moment on Crossfire when Jon Stewart was the guest, and mm-hmm. It was Paul Begala and the guy with Fox that wears the bow tie.
Tucker.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson, and he absolutely humiliated them and said, "You're hurting America." And the amazing thing was that they got fired, though, didn't they? Right away, they closed the program down. Somebody at CNN realized that Jon Stewart was right.
Yeah, no, that show didn't last a whole lot longer after that. But unfortunately, I think the ethos of that show it's still very much alive. It's just, you know, the conceit of Crossfire was a liberal and a conservative debating under one roof, and they would never come to an agreement about something. One of the things that Stewart did that I thought was brilliant was he asked them to say something, each one to say something nice about an opposing politician, and they literally couldn't do it. They couldn't break out of character. They were like afraid to. But now what we see is we have liberal outlets and we have conservative outlets, and they don't argue in the same show. They sort of argue across the ether, most viewers are essentially in bubbles, as you talked about before. Like, you have conservative viewers, you have liberal viewers, and they only consume one or the other, which is essentially the same thing. It's even more divisive than the old model.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. He's the author of I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street, and the New York Times bestsellers Insane Clown President, The Divide, Griftopia, and The Great Derangement. And his latest book just out is Hate Inc., How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate Each Other, Your Campaign 2020 Guide to Media Deception. So let's talk about both of the issues in the subtitle of your book. You write that we've discovered we can sell hate. The more vituperative the rhetoric, the better. This also serves mm-hmm. larger political purposes. So long as the public is busy hating each other and not aiming its ire at the more complex financial and political processes going on off camera, there is very little danger of anything like a popular uprising. So are we all being suckered here into a bread and circuses distraction?
You know, I think so. I mean, this has been a frustration for me in my career. Well, you know, what I've discovered is that the most serious problems that investigative journalists write about tend to be bipartisan. They tend to be little known. They tend to be complicated, bureaucratic. I mean, I think a great example would be, for instance, the accounting failures at the Defense Department. You know, we've seen some academic studies suggesting that basically one out of every two of our tax dollars has gone into this, you know, Enron-esque black hole where we have not billions but trillions of dollars of monies unaccounted for. But we don't really do stories like that because you can't blame it on one party or the other. It's a problem that's persisted across multiple administrations, and this is true also of stories like surveillance, torture, you know, drone assassination, environmental problems, you know, corporate subsidies. But the one thing that we do a lot of is, you know, we'll do partisan confrontation. So anything involving Donald Trump, the left-leaning media is going to go hog wild over anything that is negative about Trump, and then on the opposite side, the Fox people are going to go crazy about the opposite. So that's what my complaint is. We don't do systemic institutional stuff as much as we do the personality-driven partisan stuff, and I think that's unfortunate.
Well, but the insane clown president that you covered in the 2016 campaign is a genius at distraction, is he not? He's the very embodiment of the problem that you just outlined.
Yeah, no, I did do that book, and it was certainly not complimentary towards Donald Trump. I did try to, you know, I tried very hard to explain the sort of nature of why Trump had become popular and the nature of his support and the reasons that he didn't fall by the wayside in the same way that previous fringe candidates had. But, you know, I think with the negative pattern that we fell into with Trump was that we started to recognize the entertainment value of what he was doing. He started to make everybody lots and lots of money from the very, very beginning. And so he would do something crazy, like he would say, oh, Hillary Clinton got schlonged by Obama in 2008. And, you know, that turned into 2 full weeks of news stories that, you know, were on the front pages of the major dailies in America. And, you know, did we do that because that was a legitimate news story or because it sold newspapers? And that was the genius of Trump, is that he understood that we couldn't resist that kind of story. And it got him billions of dollars in free coverage. And it was unfortunate.
That's right. Les Moonves said he may be bad for the country, but he's great for CBS. So
exactly.
So far, Trump has not gone the way of Les Moonves, although maybe the porn star will drag him into that particular vortex. But just in the last few minutes, let's talk about the second part of the subtitle of Hate Inc., your campaign 2020 guide to media deception. I actually just took a 2-week vacation, went to Australia and didn't think about Trump, and I have to tell you my mental health has improved enormously, but here I am back. I'm back in the game. I have to cover him. He is the president. It feels like you're being manipulated and that you're a useful idiot in the distraction game.
Absolutely. It's so depressing. You know, when I think about having to go out there again, I think of a football fan that I ran into once who was depressed about his team, and he said, I have enough hate in my heart to start a car. That's how I feel about the campaign story. And it's very unfortunate because we know that people become extremely emotional about the campaign, and we know exactly how to wind people up about it, and we also know how to signal to people to tell them what kinds of candidates to vote for and which ones not to vote for. Like, we will tell you at the outset that so and so is a quote unquote real candidate or a presumptive front runner or somebody else's fringe, and we try to exercise all this influence over whether or not you're going to vote for the right person, and all is very tiresome. And the campaign just goes on too long. We, you know, you don't need 22 months to decide. Most people only need a week, and so it stands to reason that that there's going to be a lot of nonsense from beginning to end, for sure.
But just in closing, give our audience, if you will, Matt Taibbi, a couple of tips here. Obviously, the book is coming out online. It's free. But What are some of the things that you can guide us through to avoid the media deception in this upcoming 2020 campaign?
Yeah, and again, you can read it right now at taibbi.substack.com. I think one of the things you're going to find early on is that the press is going to, while Donald Trump is going to be tweeting nonstop about the Democratic primary season, there's going to be mountains and mountains of coverage of his tweets. And all of this is going to be designed to get you upset and to distract you from any issue reporting. I would just be very warned that there's going to be an intentional effort to try to get you caught up in that whole reality show drama, which is essentially going to be like Mystery Science Theater, but the political version. It's going to be horrible. And we know that it makes people mentally unhealthy and unhappy, but we do it anyway. So, tune it out and wait until you see a story that has something to do with people's actual political records.
Well, Matt Taibbi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Appreciate it. And again, I've been speaking with Matt Taibbi, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. He's the author of I Can't Breathe, The Killing on Bay Street, and the New York Times bestsellers Insane Clown President, The Divide, Griftopia, and The Great Derangement. And his latest book just out is Hate Inc., How and Why the Press Makes Us Hate Each Other, Your Campaign 2020 Guide to Media Deception. And that's an interview from December the 12th of 2018 with Matt Taibbi, talking about how and why the press makes us hate one another. And that, of course, summarizes very much how our politics in 2018 have been dominated by the divisions that are being exacerbated and used as a deliberate weapon by President Trump, who, through the auspices of Fox News, is able to divide the country and at the same time hold on to his diminishing base. And this has been the last of the retrospective programs from Background Briefing's coverage of the year 2018. I'd like to thank all of you for supporting us throughout this turbulent year. Not that the next one is going to be less afflicted with chaos and dysfunction, but maybe there'll be some resolution in terms of getting rid of the destroyer-in-chief in the Oval Office. And we'll be back again tomorrow with some special guests who will be looking ahead to what might be the stories that will dominate the news in 2019. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30.